It's been so long since I've preached here, you were probably wondering if I was still on the payroll. The problem when you have a gospel meeting and then a gospel meeting, and then it feels like I have not been up here in a month. I actually have not been up here in about a month. I'm very excited to preach for you again today. I'm glad to be back from Nevada. We had a great gospel meeting here last week with D. Bowman. He gave me a lot to think about. I have jumped back into preaching today with a reinvigorated sense of excitement and zeal for being with you here at Monte Vista. Not that I was really slipping in my zeal or anything before. Not that you could tell, at least. Speaking of that, I was recently meeting with my financial advisor about investments in stocks and bonds, because I'm old now and I'm doing that sort of thing. It's okay. Wow, these jokes are just not working today, are they? But really, you know, you reach a point in life where you're not a kid anymore. You're just not a kid anymore. And you got to start thinking about, you know, where you're going to be in 20 or 30 or 40 years and the state of affairs, your assets. So he gave me a lot of things to think about. Made some investments, got myself invested in retirement. And I don't think that Adam realized, my financial advisor, that while he was talking to me about money and stocks and retirement, he was actually giving me a sermon idea along the way. Even though our conversation never really veered too far away from the subject of my money, I did leave the experience with an increased appreciation for the patience, for the deliberation, and even a bit of the shrewdness that comes along with maneuvering the financial world. There's certainly something to be said about the wisdom that's involved in making smart investments, as well as the foresight that it takes to prepare for retiring someday. Maybe this is a lesson that only Craig is going to care about this morning. But what I wanted to do was take some of the things that I learned talking to my financial advisor, take them out of the financial world and apply them to the spiritual world. There are some really great truths in the financial world that I think translate very, very well into our faith and our religious experience. So today's lesson is called Fully Invested. We're going to talk about what it means to be fully invested in the things that matter, not neglecting those things, and really prioritizing in the way that we ought to the things that really mean something in this life. We're going to take these lessons from my financial advisor to see the daily parables that illustrate deeper truths about where we're going and how we're going to get there. Let's start with this idea that being a person who is fully invested means being invested in the things that actually matter. If you're going to invest in something, then do it right. That's something that I learned in talking to Adam, was if you're going to do something, do it right. There's no such thing as doing Christianity or family or morality or religion or your faith half-heartedly. There's just no way of getting around it. If you're going to have kids, have kids and do it right. If you're going to get married and do it right. Don't try to take shortcuts. Don't try to take the easy way. Don't try to do it on the cheap. And it's the same way with our religion as well. If you're going to be a Christian, then be a Christian. You cannot be a Christian in a half-hearted way and think for a moment that you're going to get anything out of it. At least get anything out of it that God would hope or expect you to get out of it. If you truly invested. I was studying the book of Malachi just the other day, and Malachi, to me, feels like this great case in point of this subject. In the entire book of Malachi, God asks the people these series of questions. He presents them with these challenges or these problems in their faith, in their worship, in their morality, in their religious practices, and they're so shocked. They're so shocked that things aren't working out. God says things to the effect of, well, if you're going to give me the blind and the lame and the broken sheep for sacrifices, what do you think I'm going to do with it? If you're going to give a father or a dignitary a certain degree of honor, but you're not going to give me the same kind of honor or more, what do you expect is going to happen? if you're going to break your covenant with the wife of your youth and get divorced, what do you think is going to happen? And it's so shocking to these people that they've lived a certain way, trying to get away with half-hearted devotion. They're not going to give God the best of their fields or their flocks. They're not going to give God the best of their devotion. They're not going to give God the very best of their hearts. So don't be surprised if religion blows up in your face, if you're not going to be fully invested in it. Children, marriage, church, even little things like learning a new skill or picking up a hobby, all of these things become very difficult if you don't fully invest yourself in them. There's a way to do things in life, and there's a way to be lazy. And you cannot be a good parent or a good spouse or a good Christian the lazy way. Let's consider a couple of applications then. Turn with me to Ephesians chapter 5. And I believe these are going to be very practical things to consider in terms of fully invested. But in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. Does that sound like half-hearted devotion to a spouse? No. Be subject as to the Lord. How you see God in a small earthly way translates to our marriages as well. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so wives ought also to be to their husbands and everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Notice in verse 28, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. Christ was willing to die for his bride, to literally, actually give his life to save his bride. Does that sound like half-hearted devotion? And he says, as Christ loved the church, so husbands ought to love their own wives. That's being fully invested in a marriage. And marriage just doesn't work if you're not fully invested. Marriage doesn't work if marriage is just a part-time activity, or if marriage is a hobby, or if marriage is an afterthought. Marriage doesn't work. And it's the same way with raising kids as well. Kids are more annoying than anything else if you're not in it for the long haul. Right? Right? If you are not fully devoted to your kids, if you are not invested in them to the point that you would give your own life and vitality for their welfare, kids are just annoying. And you see it all the time, too. You see people who are not fully devoted to their kids. They don't care what happens to their kids. They don't care what trouble their kids get into. They don't care about their kids' accomplishments or achievements. They don't care about their kids' moral victories as much as they care about their moral failures. You see parents all the time who are not fully invested in their kids. So it's no surprise that many parents are just annoyed with their kids. Their kids are a chore. Their kids are a drag on them. Parenting doesn't work if you're not fully invested. It just doesn't work. Relationships of all kinds. Go to Colossians chapter 3. Notice here the degree to which we are to be devoted to people in our relationships. In Colossians chapter 3, beginning in verse 18, wives, be subject to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Children, be obedient to your parents in all things. Devotion. Full investment. For this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not exasperate your children that they may not lose heart. Slaves or servants, in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, he says in verse 23. Look at this. Look at this devotion here. Whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men. Everything in life is made better when you fully invest yourself in it. Everything is made better in life when you fully invest yourself in it. every relationship, from the very, very greatest of relationships between you and God, you and your spouse, you and your kids, to even the smallest of relationships. Everything is made better in life when you are fully invested in something. The human body as a symbol of our interdependence is shown here in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And we don't have time to read the entire passage, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, beginning in verse 14, notice that every part of the body needs every other part of the body. What good would a pair of eyes be without everything else in the body? They're just eyes sitting on a table then. What good are feet without a brain to direct them, without a brain to guide them? What good is any part of your body when it is isolated or alienated or taken away from all of the other parts of your body? That's fully invested. Your eyes care about what happened to your feet. That's why they work together for the overall welfare of your physical body. Your hands care about what happens to your head, which is why when a football comes for your face, your hands go like this. Because they care what happens to your head. Each part of your body is invested in the other parts of the body. Now, Paul the Apostle uses that symbol, that analogy, to describe the interrelatedness of members in a church. How we all need each other in a congregation. And maybe that's more to the point of this lesson, is how can you be a Christian and not be fully invested in the activities of Christianity? One thing that is worth addressing is the practical side of this. And this is, I'm going to warn you, this is one that's going to cut real close to home for folks. This is going to be a tough one to stomach for us, okay? I'll just tell you that right now. You know, we're talking about financial investment as a parable for emotional and spiritual investment in our faith and our relationships. But is there a physical side to that investment as well? It's hard for us to accept this, but there is a physical investment that has to come with friendships. Can you be friends with people who you don't spend time with? Can you really be practicing charity if you're not willing to give of yourself for somebody else, whether it is time or energy, food, water, or even money? Isn't there a physical investment that has to come with that as well? I don't buy it. I don't buy it when people walk away from the church and say, well, they weren't very friendly. They weren't very friendly with me. No one ever had me over to their house. No one ever took me out for lunch. They were not very friendly at that church. I don't buy that. I don't buy it because there was an expectation for you to invest as well. When people have a hard time making friends at church, I want to ask them, when was the last time you brought something to a potluck and spent some time with other Christians? When people have a hard time making friends at church, I want to ask them, when was the last time you went out for lunch with somebody? Well, it's expensive to go out to restaurants. Well, you know, there's a lot of other things that you do that are expensive as well. But you make time for those things, don't you? We've spent $150 a month on a cell phone bill, but we wouldn't spend $20 to go out to Arby's with another Christian. We spend money on all kinds of things, and then we pout because, well, it's too expensive to go out to eat with other Christians. They all go out to restaurants. I can't afford to go to restaurants with other Christians. And yet there's a lot of other things that we spend our money on that are a whole lot less important than building friendships and relationships with other Christians. When was the last time you shared something that you had with somebody else? When was the last time you practiced real and meaningful charity with someone who needed it? When was the last time that you took a half hour out of your day to go visit Timothy Barge at the hospital? A half an hour! You've got a half an hour to watch TV every night. You've got a half an hour to play Angry Birds. You don't have a half an hour to go visit somebody at the hospital. And we're so shocked when we have a hard time making friends with people at church. You can't be a Christian on the cheap. I'm sorry, yeah, it does cost money to go to restaurants with other Christians. But it's worth it. It's worth it. And it's the thing I look forward to the most every Sunday. Well, you know, aside from some other things that we do on Sunday. It's worth it. Isn't it worth the drive to go to somebody's house? Isn't it worth the time to go to a potluck? isn't it worth the energy to help somebody who has a need that you can fill? No, I don't buy it. I don't buy it. Income might be disposable, but people are not. We hear the term disposable income a lot these days. You know, you spend your disposable income on a new flat screen TV, or you spend your disposable income, you know, going to frozen yogurt or something. Now, we have disposable income. Dave Ramsey, if you're familiar at all with Dave Ramsey's, Dave Ramsey's financial gospel, he has a term that he calls blow money, and it's just the money that you blow on extraneous things, unnecessary things. And, you know, you reserve a spot in your budget for just money to spend on. If you feel like buying a comic book, go out and buy yourself a comic book and have a good afternoon with that, okay? But we talk about disposable income. I want to dispel the notion, though, that relationships can be disposable. People are never extraneous or unnecessary to your life. Everybody that you know contributes something to your life, even your enemies. Notice in Matthew 5, and there's a phrase I want to point out that I think is really worth a moment's notice here. In Matthew 5, 44, "But I say to you," he says, "love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you." For what purpose? To what end? What is accomplished by loving your enemies and praying for them? Verse 45 says, "In order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven." You want to be a son of the Father who is in heaven? You have to love your enemies and pray for them then. Even your enemies contribute something to your life and who you are. Unbelievers are sometimes more shrewd about their friendships than we are. This was pointed out in Luke chapter 16. You're probably familiar with it already, but the parable of the unrighteous steward here. In Luke chapter 16, beginning in verse 1, notice the illustration that Jesus uses to talk about shrewdness in relationships. "There was a certain rich man," he says in Luke 16, verse 1, "who had a steward, and this steward was reported to him as squandering his possession. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward.' Now the steward said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master has taken the stewardship away from me? I am not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg.'" He sounds a lot like me. "I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes." And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began to say to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" He said, 100 measures of oil." And he said to him, "Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, "And how much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat." He said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. Verse 8. And his master praised the unrighteous steward because he had acted so shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. He who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you've not been faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who will entrust the true riches to you?" Now when he says unrighteous mammon is just a word for wealth. And he's not saying that all wealth is inherently unrighteous. He's just saying that in this world, compared to the investment we need to have with each other and in God, wealth is, in a sense, an unrighteous thing. But we all have unrighteous wealth. We didn't earn it unrighteously, but every dollar in your bank account is worldly wealth. It's the mammon of the world, the riches of the world. And he's saying we all have this mammon. We all have this wealth that's accessible to us. And the unrighteous people of the world are sometimes better about their relationships, their friendships, their business context than we can be. The sons of light can be such awful people sometimes. The sons of light can be so cheap sometimes. Maybe that goes back to the previous point that we were making, is you have unrighteous mammon, you have money in your bank account, and Jesus is saying, what are you spending that money on? What are you spending that money on? What are you saving it up for? What are you hoarding it for? What is the point of that unrighteous mammon if it's not
to be used to help other people and build relationships with those around you. That unrighteous steward knew that he could use money as a way to establish relationships. Now, he cooked the books and he was unrighteous. There's no denying that. But at the very least, the master admired him for his planning and his forethought and his investment in relationships. If the unrighteous steward can do such and such with his money to establish relationships, how hard should it be for the Christian to use his money to do the right thing, to be charitable, to be loving, to be hospitable, to have people into your homes, to make the physical investment in meaningful spiritual relationships? You might find yourself quite sorry someday that you dismissed people as easily as you did. When you said, well, I don't need any new friendships anyway. I've already got enough friends. I don't like spending time with other people anyway. You might find yourself really, really disappointed that you dismissed people so easily. Notice in Proverbs chapter 13, verse 11. Wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but whoever gathers little by little will increase it. Investments take time, don't they? Investments take patience. It's shocking, isn't it, when you talk to a financial advisor and he says, well, if you put this much money away, and it's just a little bit every month, over the course of 40 years, this is how much money you'll have at the end of it, barring catastrophe. My jaw dropped. I was like, I could have that much money? What? And all I have to do is that? Yeah. Man, I'm poor, you guys. I'm poor. And I could be like living it up. Of course, you know, by the time I'm 65 and getting ready to retire, that money's not going to be worth anything anymore, right? Because we're all going to be like bartering stuff, you know, like hooves, feet, and everything. I mean, that's all. I mean, we're just going to be bartering. But investments take time. Churches can be the same way, though. Churches can be the same way. A congregation that has strong leadership and a committed membership will grow. Maybe not always in the way that it expects, not necessarily in numbers, though I think that there's a connection there to the numeric growth of a congregation as well. Ask any thriving church today. Go to any congregation today that is doing really, really well. Ask them what they were like 10 years ago. Ask them what they were like 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And you will see this truth played out. Strong churches grow. Churches with leadership, churches with active involvement, churches with zealous worship, churches with solid Bible study programs grow. Any thriving church today, you ask them, 10 years ago, they were half the size they are now. They grow. Now, there might be pitfalls along the way, there might be feelings hurt or egos bruised, but consistently living by the Word will produce growth. And that's by design. Matthew chapter 13, verse 33. Notice that it is by design that growth of some kind, spiritual, emotional, and even numeric, growth of some kind will happen. The one on whom seed was sown on the good soil, this is the man who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. There's also diversification that's necessary in an investment. Solomon points this out in the book of Ecclesiastes, in Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and verse 1. Now, he is talking in a sense about physical diversification of one's assets. Notice in verse 1 of Ecclesiastes 11. Cast your bread on the surface of the water, for you will find it after many days. I think that's a symbol there. He's saying, cast your bread on the surface of the water. It will come back to you in some way. When you invest overseas, let's just kind of talk about it in modern vernacular. When you invest overseas, cast your bread on the surface of the water, that investment will eventually find its way back. There's a circuit of investment where your money goes somewhere over here, your investment goes somewhere over there, and it finds its way back when it has run the full circuit. Verse 2, divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what misfortunes may occur on the earth. And that's a really good point that he's making here. Diversification. Now, I think Solomon is saying there's wisdom in physical diversification of your assets, but anyone who's read the book of Ecclesiastes knows there's more going on than meets the eye. So what is Solomon really talking about when he's talking about divide your portion to 7 or even to 8 and it will work out for you? What is he talking about when he's talking about diversification of your assets? I think he's talking about relationships, personally. And this is how I would take it. Look outside your comfort zone for advice, wisdom, and friendship. We tend to only look for people who are similar to us. People who are similar in age. People who are similar in financial status. People who are similar in race or ethnicity or language. Look for people who are outside of your comfort zone, though. And you'll be amazed at who you will find. You'll be amazed at the relationships you build and what those relationships do for you. I've been very surprised in my life, actually, with the people who've been a great influence on me. Sometimes the greatest influences have come completely out of left field. People who I'd never realized would change me or affect me the way they did. And that includes my enemies as well. Detractors and critics. Sometimes you'll be very surprised when you look outside of your comfort zone for wisdom and friendship at what you'll find. Some of my very best friends are people who are quite a bit older than me. Some of my very best friends are people who are quite a bit younger than me. Some of the people I love the most in this world are nothing more than 6 months old. And some of the people that I miss the most live to be 80 or 90. Look outside your comfort zone. Diversify your friendships. I think that's a little bit of what's going on in 1 Timothy chapter 5. When he talks about treat other Christians as if they were family members. Look in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Do not sharply rebuke an older man, but rather appeal to him as a father, to the younger men as brothers, the older women as mothers, and the younger women as sisters in all purity. Honor widows who are widows indeed. And you have to have a relationship with these people to have that kind of situation. You actually have to know somebody before you can treat him like a father. You actually have to know somebody before he can be like a brother or before she can be like a sister. You actually have to be involved in the widow's life in order to honor that widow who is a widow indeed. You have to be involved in their lives. Have a relationship with other people. We all know the story of Rehoboam, don't we? You remember that Solomon's son Rehoboam received the kingship. When he went for his coronation, he had Israel, the northern tribes, complaining at him because of heavy taxes. He went and talked to the older folks, the older advisors, the men who advised his father, and they all said, "You have got to relieve the burden on the people. Relieve their burden." And he didn't like that plan. So he talked to his buddies, his contemporaries, his peers, and they all said, "Oh yeah, if the people are going to complain at you about taxes and heavy burdens, this is what you should do." And he comes out and says, "I'm going to throw scorpions at all of you." You know, in a sense. And that was bad advice. That was bad advice because he did not have a diversified array of people who he trusted and listened to for wisdom. That, you know, it can be kind of uncomfortable. I understand that. It can be uncomfortable when we don't feel like we have a connection to somebody else, but that's why we get to know them. The more you get to know somebody, and this is a truism, the more you get to know somebody, the more likely it is that you're going to discover a connection there. You get to know someone, you find out that you grew up in the same hometown. Now, maybe you grew up 50 years apart, but there's a connection there. You get to know somebody and you find out quite unexpectedly that you like the exact same book. That your favorite movie is his favorite movie. That you like the same exotic cuisine. You get to know somebody, build a relationship, And you might be very surprised at the connections that you build. The last point that we'll make this morning is learn to trust others. I had to take my money and hand it over to somebody else so that he could take my money and invest it in what can only be described over the last 5 to 10 years as a rather volatile stock market. You know what's funny? The week after I poured several thousand dollars into this thing, the stock market lost like 600 points in a week. Every day that next week, it lost 100 points, and then 200 points, and then 100 points, and then 200. And I wanted to call him and be like, never mind! Never mind! Get it all out! Put it in a mattress! You've got to trust other people, though. Trust other people with your assets. Trust that they know what they're doing and that they have your best interests at heart. I trust my financial advisor. He's 31, just like me. Who wouldn't trust a 31-year-old? You're all here this morning, aren't you? And I think a good illustration of this is in Matthew chapter 25. If you recall in Matthew 25, beginning in verse 14, the parable here of the talents. There's a master who's going to go on a long journey, and he takes some of his assets, and he entrusts those assets to three of his servants. Now, he gives a different portion to those servants. One servant receives the greatest portion. Another servant receives a very small portion. But he does give a portion to each of them according to what he knows they're capable of doing. Now, two of them take the portion that they have and they invest it, they do something with it, and they make profit for their master. He's very pleased with that. But I think the point that I want to make here is not necessarily the overall point from the parable. I just want to focus on this idea of that he trusted his servants. He took his capital, his resources, and he said, here, do something with it. Make me happy. I'm going to be gone. I can't micromanage you. I can't tell you exactly what to do with it. I can't be there for every step of the process. I can't hold your hand every step of the way. But these are my assets. Do something with them while I'm gone. And he left. And he trusted them. Now, do some people disappoint? Yeah, the one talent man sure disappointed. The one talent man didn't have enough foresight to even put that money in the bank so that it could accrue interest. So sure, sometimes people disappoint us. Sometimes people fail us. Sometimes they're not worthy of our trust. But does that mean we should take everything out? Stuff our money in our mattress? Hide from the world? No. It's hard to trust elders. It's hard to let the elders make their decisions in their wisdom, by God's word, and not second guess everything they say. We're very independent in America, aren't we? We do not like giving up any degree of our independence. And it takes a leap of faith to say to three men, I trust you with my growth, my development, and my discipline. I trust you. It's hard to fully support an evangelist in his work, to trust an evangelist, to trust that that evangelist is actually doing something all week long, to trust that what that evangelist is saying has been studied out thoroughly. It's hard to trust. Is it hard to trust a spouse all the time? To make vows to that spouse that says, I'm going to fully commit myself to you, trusting that you will fully commit yourself to me? Is it hard to trust our kids when they first go out on their own? When they first start tasting responsibility for the first time? It's hard to trust people. But you have to learn to trust if you're going to grow. You can't do it by yourself. You can't do it by yourself. One of the greatest tragedies in any kind of relationship is an unwillingness to trust another person. We do not trust, so we refuse to be honest. We do not trust, so we never witness their potential being met. We do not trust, so we don't give them a chance to be an influence on us or somebody else. If you don't trust God, for example, why should you be so shocked that you get nothing from Him? So I want to ask the question then. What's keeping you from fully investing? Whether it's fully investing in your marriage, truly living up to the vows that you made on your wedding day, fully investing in your kids and realizing that, yes, I am giving my very best years to them. I'm never going to be 31 again, my friends. I am never going to be this young, this active, ever again in my life. And I am giving these years to my kids because I'm fully invested in them. Why are you not fully investing in the work of the church? Why do you always have one foot in the door and one foot out of the door when it comes to church activities, relationships with other people, trusting the elders, trusting the deacons, trusting me? Why are you not fully invested in God, who is so fully invested in you, who loves you so much that He gave His only begotten Son for you? You want to talk about full investment? Jesus Christ dying on the cross was full investment. Why are you not investing now? Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Now is your opportunity to make life right, to become a part of God's kingdom, to believe in His Son, to be baptized in His name, and to live a life that is fully devoted, fully invested in the things that truly matter. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.